She looked again at Hawser. The face of the man on the stretcher was white as snow and as blank. The features were there, eyes, nose, brows, mouth, but they seemed somehow unlinked and disconnected, giving a look of anonymity to a face lacking all character, animation and depth. It was as though all the people, all the characterizations, all the parts the man had played in his life had leaked out of him in his coma and taken their own little share of his real self with them, leaving him empty, wiped clean. The drone supporting the floating stretcher babbled briefly in a tongue Belveda couldn't recognize, its voice echoing down the tunnel. Then it fell silent. The mind floated, still and dull silver, its patchy, mirror rainbow surface reflecting her, the dim light outside, and the man and the drone from its ellipsoid shape. She got to her feet and with one hand pushed the stretcher out over the moonlit snow toward the ship, her legs sinking into the whiteness up to her thighs. A steel-blue shadow of the struggling woman was thrown to one side in the silence, away from the moon and toward the dark and distant mountains, where a curtain of storm clouds hung like a deeper night. Behind the woman, her tracks led back, deep and scuffed to the tunnel's mouth. She cried quietly with the effort of it all, and the numbing pain of her wounds. A couple of times on her way, she raised her head to the dark form of the ship, a mixture of hope and fear on her face as she waited for the blast and splash of warning laser light, which would tell her that the craft's autoguard did not accept her, that the drone and Hawser's suit were both too damaged to be recognizable to the ship, that it was over, and she was doomed to die here, 100 meters from safety and escape, but held from it by a set of faithful automatic unconscious circuits. The lift swung down when she applied the ring from Hawser's hand to the elevator controls. She put the drone and the man into the hold. The drone murmured. The man was quiet and motionless as a fallen statue. She had intended to switch off the ship's autoguard and go back immediately for the mind, but the man's icy stillness frightened her. She went for the emergency medical kit and turned up the heating in the hold. But when she got back to the stretcher, the cold, blank-faced changer was dead. Appendices. The Adiran Culture War. The following three passages have been extracted from a short history of the Adiran War. English language, Christian calendar version, original text AD 2110, unaltered. Edited by Parharan Gaiza Listach Jaandizi Petrain Dam Kotosklo. The work forms part of an independent, non-commissioned but contact-approved Earth Extra Information Pack. Reasons. The Culture. It was, the culture knew from the start, a religious war in the fullest sense. The culture went to war to safeguard its own peace of mind, no more. But that peace was the culture's most precious quality, perhaps its only true and treasured possession. In practice, as well as theory, the culture was beyond considerations of wealth or empire. The very concept of money, regarded by the culture as a crude, overcomplicated and inefficient form of rationing, was irrelevant within the society itself, where the capacity of its means of production ubiquitously and comprehensively exceeded every reasonable, and in some cases perhaps unreasonable, demand its not unimaginative citizens could make. These demands were satisfied, with one exception, from within the culture itself. Living space was provided in abundance, chiefly on matter-cheap orbitals. Raw material existed in virtually inexhaustible quantities, both between the stars and within stellar systems, and energy was, if anything, even more generally available through fusion, annihilation, the grid itself, or from stars, taken either indirectly as radiation absorbed in space or directly tapped at the stellar core. Thus, the culture had no need to colonize, exploit, or enslave. The only desire the culture could not satisfy from within itself was one common to both the descendants of its original human stock and the machines they had, at however great a remove, brought into being: the urge not to feel useless. The culture's sole justification for the relatively unworried, hedonistic life its population enjoyed was its good works, the secular evangelism of the contact section, not simply finding, cataloguing, investigating and analysing other, less advanced civilizations, but, where the circumstances appeared to contact to justify so doing, actually interfering, overtly or covertly, in the historical processes of those other cultures. With a sort of apologetic smugness, contact, and therefore the culture, could prove statistically that such careful and benign use of the technology of compassion, to use a phrase in vogue at the time, did work, in the sense that the techniques it had developed to influence a civilization's progress did significantly improve the quality of life of its members, without harming that society as a whole by its very contact with a more advanced culture.